Thank you very much. Can you snag my water here? Thanks. Well, it's really great to be here in Birmingham. I mean, it really is a privilege to come down here. And I'm really impressed with what you've set up here with your weekend and everything. It's just great. Well, my name is Mel Barger, and I came from Nebraska. I was born in Nebraska, 1925. That makes me 89 now. And I had the idea that part of my problem was growing up in Nebraska. There was something that it was the Depression, and things were kind of bad there. They had the drought and the dust storms and everything like that. And I guess I grew up in what they now call a dysfunctional family. And I used to blame a lot of my problems on that. My parents divorced in the middle 30s and that kind of thing. But I guess we can't really blame anybody but ourselves if we're going to be successful with this program. We take responsibility for what goes wrong. And usually when things do go wrong, we're behind it one way or another. I remember a friend of mine was really sorry because he lost a lot of money. He had embezzled some money and somebody else stole it. I did have a lot of trouble with self-esteem growing up. I had an older sister who was a very good student, a younger brother who was a good athlete, but I didn't seem to excel in many things. I was a poor student. I even flunked the first grade. I had to repeat the first grade. And I started school in a little Sand Hills country school out in the Sand Hills part of Nebraska. My dad was a traveling salesman, and my parents' marriage was probably sour from the start, but they divorced when I was in about the fourth or fifth grade, and I carried a chip on my shoulder about that for many years. Blamed a lot of things on my stepmother, who accused her of breaking up the family and that sort of thing. But now I look back and I see that I had many advantages. My stepmother, she always encouraged my writing business, that I became a business writer, and I've written some books, as Bill mentioned. In fact, my books would all be bestsellers if more people would buy them. what happened, I got into AA went to my first meeting when I was 23, about a month after my 23rd birthday. And I stayed sober 5 or 6 months, and then I started kicking the program around and got back in about a year later. I was back home in Nebraska living with my mother and stepdad, kind of leeching on them, you might say. And I went into the state hospital there and spent 7 weeks, and I haven't had a drink since. That my sobriety date was April 15th, 1950. And sometimes people wonder, or it seems strange that we have things like these countdowns, you know, where we have a big conference and everything, and then we have a sobriety countdown to see how long different people have stayed sober. But I think that serves a purpose. It shows that AA has staying power. We have people in AA that stay sober. They're here for the long pull. There's no question about it. We stay sober a day at a time, of course, but we don't have the idea that we're going to be drinking down the road. That's why we never use the term on the wagon. I don't have ever heard that much in AA. because that's what drunks always did. They got on the wagon now and then, but there was always an idea that maybe you'd get off the wagon at a certain time. But it's better just to stay sober a day at a time and forget about the wagon. I must have, I have a belief that alcoholics are almost doomed to become alcoholics, that this is partly a physical thing, that we get something out of alcohol that the other person doesn't. We get a certain kind of buzz, maybe, that the other guy doesn't get that much. Now, that's just my idea. But right from the start, I heard that AA was an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. Well, the term allergy is not a very accurate word, because usually when you're allergic to something, you break out as something bad. You get the hives or something like that. But with alcohol, the allergy causes you to want more. Once we start drinking, why, bingo, we're off to the races. And that's the one thing we learn in AA right away, that there's no way that we can ever become moderate drinkers, controlled drinkers, or anything like that. A lot of people have wasted a lot of time and caused a lot of trouble by thinking they could ever become moderate drinkers again. And that's just not in the cards for us for some reason. I remember that an uncle told me that I got drunk when I was 4 years old. I don't remember that, but my dad had the idea that if you allowed somebody to drink in a moderate way when they were growing up, they would never become drunks. Well, I shot the hell out of that theory. And, you know, I don't think my dad ever really accepted that I had become a drunk. I remember he came from southwestern Kentucky, and a couple times he came out to Michigan, and I took him back to where he had grown up. And I remember we stopped at some place, and he got a beer, and I got a Pepsi. And I remember him staring at the Pepsi, and I was just sure he was going to say, "Now, Melvin, why can't you take a drink like a man," or something like that. I just had that feeling. He didn't say it, but that was his belief. Well, it doesn't, in spite of that, we can't blame our drinking on anybody else but ourselves. We drink because we want to drink. And that's when you go into why people drink, it's because they want to. And there's something about alcoholism. No matter how much trouble we get into, we go back out unless we do something about the problem. AA is really one of the great miracles of the 20th century. Some people have considered it have said that, and I believe that too. I think it's amazing the way the founders of AA got together and somehow hammered out this program. I was always interested in the history of AA a short time after I started going to meetings. For example, I went to my first meeting in Santa Paula, California. I was living in Ventura, California, about 10 miles away. And there was a lot of publicity about AA, and I was having trouble, so I wrote them a letter. And a couple of days later, a guy called me, and he took me over to some people's house. And my gosh, they were people from Akron. One fellow was one of the first 2,000 members of AA. And a short time later, I met his son-in-law, who was one of the first 200 members of AA. So I was getting some AA history right at the start without even knowing it. They also talked about, this was in 1948 that I went to my first meetings, and they also talked about the pioneers of AA that they had known in Akron. For example, the AA number 3 was a fellow named Bill Dodson, and his story is in the big book. It's called Anonymous Number 3, I believe. And they called him the guinea pig. And some years later, I had moved to Michigan, and I went over to Akron, and I spent a day with Bill Dodson, and I discovered that he didn't like being called the guinea pig. Apparently, Bill Wilson had given him that name. There was some big meeting, and Bill Wilson was speaking, and the other old-timers were sitting in the back in a row, and when Bill Wilson got to the point of talking about Bill Dodson, he gestured in his direction and said, "The guinea pig." And you know, I think Bill Dodson had a resentment about that the rest of his life, of Bill Wilson having called him the guinea pig. But anyway, AA history did fascinate me right from the start. The first thing I learned was this business about the allergy of the body coupled with the obsession of the mind. Now, some people may have considered that a cop-out. That, you know, I didn't know how to handle my booze properly, and so I blamed it on an allergy or something like that. Well, there is some susceptibility. And, of course, we accept that with other things. People know that we're a diabetic, has to watch what he takes in, and there's other things we can be allergic to in different ways. And so why shouldn't alcohol be the same way? And then also explains why some people seem to have everything going for them, and then they start to drink, and they just blow their lives up. I think that's proved by the fact that there are some people who never took a drink until they were 25 or 30 years old, and then they just exploded into alcoholism. That shows that there was something there waiting to be triggered, and all they needed was exposure to alcohol to start doing that. I remember reading one guy's biography, and he never had a drink until he was past 30. But he had destroyed himself by the time he was 40, something in that neighborhood. And that just shows that there's something that makes it impossible for the alcoholic to drink in a controlled way. And the tragic thing about this is that there are some people that never learn that. They come to AA and they hear everything. People explain what it's like. And yet as they walk out the door, they'll still say, "Well, I think I'm man enough to handle it," or something like that. And it just doesn't work that way. But anyway, I had this susceptibility to alcohol. Right from the start, I didn't get along in many areas of my life. I didn't get along with other people very well, with the other kids. And I didn't get along very well in school. And when I was about 13 or 14, I got into some of my dad's wine. Now, an uncle had told me that I had gotten drunk when I was 4 years old. I don't know if that was true or not. But when I got into this wine one afternoon, I really had a feeling that I hadn't had before. And so then I remembered that. And when I was about 15, I had dropped out of high school, and I wound up out in California, in Vallejo, California, and lived there for about a year. And that's right close to the Napa Valley, which is where all the wine is produced. The Napa Valley is just known for a lot of wine. And you could get a quart of wine for something like 95 cents. So any bum on the street, if he had just begged a dollar, he could stay drunk all day. It was that simple. That's why a lot of people are winos. People used to think a wino is worse than a person who drinks whiskey or beer. And you'd see some guy that was acting real goofy. "Oh, he's a wino." Well, winos are just people who drink wine because it's cheap. They'll drink your beer or your Seven Crown if you've got that. Chivas Regal if you want to give it to them. Anything that's got alcohol in it, the alcoholic's gonna want. For example, after I'd left home, I worked in Denver at the Army Hospital, and I got sick, and they hospitalized me for a day or two right there in the same hospital. And they gave me a big glass of, must have been cold syrup or something, but it contained alcohol. Well, I drank the whole thing. And by the time the nurse came back, I was drunk. And also, when I worked in this Army hospital, I discovered I could drink beer there in the PX, just along with the soldiers and other people. So I got along with drinking pretty well when I was 14, 15, 16 years old. And so it was very easy for me to slide into alcoholism. Well, in 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And a couple years later, they still weren't winning the war, so I got in the Navy. And things started turning in our favor about that time. And I don't take all the credit for that. Guys like Admiral Nimitz, they did a little bit of their part there. But I signed up for the Navy when I was 17 and a half until I was 21 years old. And it just seemed to me that going into the Navy was the signal that I could drink all I wanted, and it's the thing you were supposed to do. Now, there were a lot of people in the Navy who didn't drink, but I took it as an excuse, and I did plenty of drinking. I wound up out in the Pacific. I got into some of the last major landings of World War II. I was at Saipan in June of 43, and then I got on a landing-type ship. They called them LSTs. They had bow doors. They could slide right up onto the beach and carry tanks and other vehicles right onto the beach. The name of the ship was a landing ship tank, LST. We called them large slow targets because they only went 8 or 9 knots an hour. I was then in the Palau Islands, and then at Leyte in the Philippines and Ligayan Gulf. These were major battles. And finally at Okinawa, which was the last major landing of World War II. And there was one incident that stood out. We carried beer on the ship, but you weren't allowed to drink it on the ship. If we would be in a place that had a recreation area, why, they would give you 3 cans of beer, and you'd go ashore, and you could play softball and drink your beer and that kind of thing. We didn't even have to pay for the beer. Well, we stopped we were anchored off the island of Samar in the Philippines, and they had a recreation area on Samar. And as I got off the land, our landing boats were also our liberty boats, and as I got onto the dock, a Filipino came up, and he had his shirt stuffed full of beer bottles. And he said that this was whiskey, a potato whiskey. And it was $5 or 10 pesos a bottle. Well, when the guy approached me, I didn't have any thought of buying any of his potato whiskey because I wasn't sure that it was very good stuff. I mean, that was even safe to drink. I think we were even warned about maybe not to buy that stuff. Well, anyway, I had my 3 cans of beer, and another guy gave me his 3 cans of beer, and I bought 3 more for $1 a can, and then suddenly I couldn't buy any more beer. Well, I'd had my 9 cans of beer, and I needed something more to drink. By gosh, I looked up the potato whiskey man, And I remember buying one bottle of it, and then I remember buying another bottle, and the next thing I knew, it was 0400. That's 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was in the landing boat, hoisted aboard on the davits, and they had carried me to the boat. I had passed out from this so-called potato whiskey. And you know, we left that day for Okinawa. April 1st, we landed on Okinawa. I think I was still seeing some spots in my eyes from that potato whiskey. And I didn't get anything out of that experience at the time, except, too bad you can't get good stuff to drink in the Philippines or something like that. But, of course, it was my own fault. Once I started drinking, I had to keep on. And as it turned out, the only thing available anymore was the potato whiskey. And that should have taught me that I had some susceptibility to alcohol that was different from what other people had. Well, I got out of the Navy, and then I had some savings piled up, and I stayed continuously drunk until this money was gone. And I didn't realize that I was that there was no limit to my drinking. I must have stayed sober 50 or 60 days without realizing it. I became probably what was you'd call a periodic drunk, simply because I didn't have the means to keep on drinking without stopping. And you know, the only people that can drink continuously without stopping are the guys on Skid Row who can mooch their booze, or somebody who's rich enough they don't have to work or anything like that. The rest of us, we have to at least go to work or do something in order to stay drunk. But by the time, by 1947 or 48, I think I had slipped in, I could have been called an alcoholic, maybe even before that. Well, maybe we could be called alcoholics right from the start, but my behavior, the things I was doing, showed that it was not, that I didn't have my life under control at all. I moved out to Idaho, where my father lived, and I didn't do very well at all there. I was going to school on the GI Bill of Rights, but not doing too well with that either. And finally, in January of 1948, I found myself in a little town of Oregon, or Weezer, Idaho. These places are right on the Snake River. And I was broke, and I hung over, and yet I didn't want to go back to my dad's house. So I went out and worked on a railroad gandy gang for about a month. And that was a scary situation. They had these guys that lived on these railroad cars, and they worked on the track. You know, they put in ties and straightened out the railroad and did the ballast and that sort of thing. And you lived right on the railroad car. They even had their own cook and everything. Well, that kind of scared me, that with being with these guys, because most of them had spent years just living up and down the Union Pacific Railroad, and they hardly had the clothes on their backs. And some of them had also been in all the jails along the way. They'd even talk about, be sure and stay out of that jail in Pocatello. They're terrible. Or those Mormons in Salt Lake City, they'll give you a bad time. I didn't want to go to jail, but I got paid, and I went into this town of Weezer, Idaho, and by God, I woke up in jail, and I didn't even know where I'd been. And it turned out that they had found me passed out on the sidewalk. And there were some Indians in jail, too. These were Navajos that they had brought up there to work on the railroad. And I think the Indians were in jail just for drinking. I think it was still against the law to sell to Indians. There was a time, you know, in the United States when Indians couldn't go in a bar and just buy a drink like anybody else. But anyway, I wound up in jail with these Navajo Indians and got out and discovered that they'd found me passed out on the sidewalk. And I went back and stayed at my dad's house for a while. And then I went over to Boise, about 30 miles away, and got drunk. And I took a cab back without a cent to pay the cab driver. Now, I don't know why I did that, but I wound up in jail over it. Maybe I thought I'd get into town and I'd open the door and run like hell. But the cab driver apparently had had people like me before, and he took me right to jail, and I couldn't pay him. And so I had to serve a jail sentence over that. And now that's insane behavior, you know, when you do things like that. But a short time later, I left there and went down to California. And my sister and brother-in-law, I moved in with them a while. They weren't very happy to see me, but most alcoholics, they wear out their relatives in time, and that's what I did too. But I went to work in the oil fields for a while. Around Ventura there, they had a number of oil fields, and I worked in that for a short time. And the summer of 1948 got to be pretty bad. Well, the local paper was running articles about AA. And the AA group also had a classified ad. And as my drinking got worse that summer, I even went down to the Veterans Hospital because I was blaming the Navy for my situation. And that didn't do me much good. But finally, I got in a real bad situation and I dropped a letter to the AA address. And by gosh, a couple of days later, a fellow called me and took me to those first meetings. And that's where I first started to learn about AA history. As I said, one of the first members I met was one of the first 2,000 members of AA, and his son-in-law, who also lived in Ventura, was one of the first 200 members. And right away, I started learning something about AA history. It was just a subject that grabbed me right from the beginning. And, well, I stayed sober 5 months, and then I started arguing with the program, and I started drinking again. And I had 13 months where I'd stay sober a short time, and then go on another drunk, and so on. But finally, in April, I think it was April 15th, I was living with my mother and stepdad in Nebraska, and a neighbor lady came over, and I was having, the morning after sort of thing. I was drinking a bottle of Pabst Blue Ribbon. Now, that's for some reason, that was the kind of beer I liked, although I would also use some Bud now and then. And, you know, nowadays when I go by in there, I'll see a billboard, and it'll say, "This Bud's for you." And I'll think, "Well, it's not for me." But anyway, I was drinking this last bottle of Pabst Blue Ribbon, or at least that was my last drink. And this lady talked me into going out to the state hospital, which was on a hill overlooking the town. It's not in business anymore. Many of those state hospitals have been closed up. But I did. I went out there for 7 weeks. And I got back in AA, and I've stayed in the fellowship ever since. That was April 15th. And I don't think there's ever been a week that I've gone by without going to a meeting. And usually I go to two or three in Toledo I go to one every noon. It's just something I do. And there's just... We live in a place like Toledo. We probably have 100 meetings a week or more, a lot more than that. So there's usually no reason any of us can avoid or can use an excuse for not going to a meeting, because there are meetings in the daytime and in the evening and so on. And I just believe that one key to staying continuously sober is to keep going to the meetings. Now, you have to do other things. You have to work the program, try to follow the steps, the principles, and all of that. Try to work with others. But just going to the meetings does a lot. Because you go there, and you're contributing. You're there. And I don't think any one person can do more, there's a saying, all of us know more than any one of us. A person, you can have people at the meeting that are pretty knowledgeable about the program, a lot of experience, but the whole group, they've got something to contribute, and that's why I believe strongly in the meetings. I think we got to be follows the principles too. Be honest and be truthful, you know. Just be honest about ourselves, about what our life is like. Try to be honest with ourselves. Because one of the alcoholic's problems is always kidding himself. You know, when I was still drinking, I would come off a bad drunk, and then, I'd go in a bar just to have a Coke. Well, I never went in. They couldn't keep that place open if they people just went in to have Cokes. They're there to sell booze and not Cokes. And so I would always be dishonest with myself when I do that. If I went in to have a Coke, it was probably to drink. And I learned that. Then also, I feel there's such a thing as cash register honesty. We shouldn't be stealing things. I remember not long ago, I went up to the Hyatt up in Dearborn, Michigan, and I was packing up, and I noticed a nice soap dish, like a seashell. And my wife likes seashells. So I was going to take this soap dish, and then I thought, God, that's really bad. It's bad enough that I'm taking the towels. That's Clancy pulls that one. He always talks about how hard it is to close his suitcase because there's too many towels in it. But anyway, after I had my second runaround and I got sober, I took my last drink in April of 1950. And I've just stayed close to AA ever since. And I believe that if I were to move to another community today, one of the first things I'd do is connect with an AA group. There's some people use moving as an excuse to drift away from AA. They might be loyal to the meetings, attending meetings where they live, but then they move and they happen to forget to find out where the groups are, and they quit going to meetings just because they've moved. Very dangerous thing. I believe the best way to ensure your long-term sobriety is to keep loyal to the meetings. Keep identifying yourself as an AA member. And and be honest about things connected with the program. I had this interest in AA history right from the start, and I was interested in Bill Wilson's writings. Now, Bill Wilson, I think we are so fortunate that our founder, key founder, the senior founder, was a guy like Bill Wilson. If you ever really want to get to know Bill, the best way is to read a book called The Language of the Heart. These are Bill's articles from the grapevine over the years. And Bill really wrote some marvelous stuff. And when problems came up, he always seemed to have the answer to them. For example, AA never came under attack until about 1963. And then Harper's Magazine, it's kind of an intellectual magazine, they ran an article, AA, Cult or Cure. And this was written by a guy who apparently had a graduate degree from Columbia University. And, AA members across the country were just furious. Now, nobody in AA ever read Harper's until then. But, boy, this cover story came out, and, boy, people were really pissed. Well, Bill was still living then, and they came to him, and Bill said, "Well, I always knew something like this would happen. I didn't know that it would be Harper's." But they wanted Bill to write some rebuttal or something. Well, Bill was very much against fighting back, attacking anybody who attacked you. So instead he wrote an article which is available today in The Language of the Heart. And it was called, "Our Critics Can Be Our Benefactors." And the point was that we're not perfect in AA and we make mistakes. And many times our critics are pointing out things that we should correct. And when they do that, they're our benefactors. And then there's also the case where people wrongly attack us for something and they got their facts wrong. Well, Bill thought when that happens, we should get our friends maybe to straighten them out. We shouldn't do it ourselves. Friends pointed out that they've been an error there. There's a saying, people are entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. If something happened, it's a fact, and that's it. And then also, Bill warned against fighting back because the critics would just use that as a platform for further attacks. You could keep on going with this sort of thing. And you know, I think the guy who wrote that article, I think he wanted to make a criticism of AA a cottage industry for himself. He did write a book and maybe a couple more articles in other publications, and then it just died out. But I think he wanted to become the Ralph Nader of AA. But it didn't work out that way because AA didn't rise to the bait. A few AAs responded or fought back, but it didn't amount to much. And I don't think it hurt AA at all. More recently, there's been an attack, I believe, in Atlantic magazine. And I don't think that amounted to much. I forget what it was about. I bought the magazine and remember reading the article. But there was nothing really serious. Nobody can really hurt AA, I think, from the outside. We could hurt ourselves by what we do with the program. But I don't think outside critics can hurt us that much. Well, it's been a great trip for me in AA. Did you say something over there? Excuse me. It's really been my life. Just going to meetings ever since 1950. And most of my friends are AA people. And I probably go to 5 or 7 meetings a week in Toledo. You know, we have great AA in Toledo, by the way. We've lived in Toledo 43 years. And I don't know why, but for some reason, Toledo is a town that people have laughed at over the years. I think that went back to the vaudeville days. If you had to play Toledo, you were second rate or something like that. But I've always thought Toledo is a great town. But the people make jokes about Toledo. They say that they had a contest up in Minnesota, and the first prize was a week in Toledo. Second prize was 2 weeks in Toledo. But it's been a great town for me. When I worked for the Libby Owens Ford Company in public relations, and had a pretty good career there over the years. Incidentally, the word career, you hear in AA people talk about their drinking careers. And it occurred to me recently that alcoholics are the only people who have drinking careers. A moderate drinker never talks about his drinking career, but alcoholic is a person who makes a career out of it. And so that's a good thing to remember, that we're all always more susceptible than the other person. Along the way, I also did some AA history of my own. I wrote some books, of course, which Bill mentioned. I always wanted to write a biography of Bill Wilson. And, of course, a lot of people did. There were best-selling writers who wanted to write Bill's biography, and he always resisted when he could. But after he had died, the AA General Services decided to write a biography of, produce a biography of Dr. Bob, and then one of Bill Wilson. And for some reason, they decided to do the Dr. Bob biography first. Maybe because they thought it would depend on interviews with a lot of the old-timers who were disappearing quickly. And so they had to get those interviews down and written before they had all passed on. And they felt with Bill they could do it more from research. So they had a fellow named Niles Peebles that worked on the Dr. Bob biography. And that came out as, I think, about in the early 90s or somewhere along the line, as Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Pretty good job. I remember I went over to Akron and I bought a copy of it. And I had thought Bill Dodson's wife, that was the wife of AA number 3, I had thought that she had passed on. And somebody told me, oh no, she's living with her son and his family over in Firestone Park. And so I called her up and I told her I had met the Dodsons before. Of course, Bill Dodson had passed on. And she invited me to come over, and I brought a copy of this book for her, of Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And she was blind by this time. She had been a matron at the Akron City Jail, and she was retired from the police department. But she was just a lovely woman, and she told me about how Bill Dodson, her husband, got into the AA program. She was a religious woman, and both she and Bill had grown up in Kentucky, and even had, were maybe distantly related. She didn't know, but her name was Dodson, too, before they were married. I'm not putting Kentucky down, because there are some people down there who aren't related to each other. My dad came from Kentucky, and I was always taught that you're much superior if you were born in Kentucky than if you grew up in Nebraska. Well, anyway, though, Bill had developed this drinking problem, and it wasn't continuous. He wasn't a guy that was drunk all the time or anything like that. And he was also a very mild guy who never gave anybody any trouble. He was really one of the nicest men you ever met. But when he drank, he just became wild and beat up on a couple of nurses and that kind of thing. And they'd had to put him in City Hospital there in Akron. Akron has two main hospitals. They have City Hospital, which is where Dr. Bob practiced. And then they had St. Thomas, which is where Sister Ignatia worked, and eventually where Dr. Bob practiced too. But anyway, Bill Dodson kept having these outbreaks of drunkenness where he would beat up on the nurses when they put him in the hospital, and they just couldn't understand it. He would be going along fine and not drinking at all, and then suddenly he'd just break out in a terrible drunk. Well, one day she stopped to see a minister who wasn't her regular minister. And they started praying about Bill's alcoholism. And she somehow got the feeling, as a result of these prayers, that there was going to be some kind of answer. And, well, Bill goes on one of his drunks and goes to the hospital. But when she went to the hospital to see him, Dr. Bob and Bill were in there. And she said right away, when she met those two men, she knew that was the answer, and that Bill wasn't going to drink again. And by gosh, he left the hospital and never had another drink. I think he stayed sober 15 or 20 years. And so it was an answer to her prayers or something. She always believed it was. I said she was a matron at the Akron City Jail. But I think she was wasn't the usual. You think of a matron in a city jail as a real tough butch type, but she wasn't that type at all. And I think she probably helped a number of women get in the program. Because what better place to find some than in the city jail? It's amazing to me also how these groups got started and how AA got started in different places. I think most of us know what the history of AA in Ohio was, how Bill Wilson came out there. He was trying. Bill was a stockbroker, and he had kind of got into a business where you would solicit proxies for control of companies. He got in with a group of people, and they financed his trip out to Akron. A company called National Rubber Machinery was up for grabs, and they thought if they could get enough proxies, that's the right to vote people's shares, why they could take over the company. Well, Bill had been sober about 6 months, and he wasn't doing very good in the employment area. Lois was working in a department store for a pretty small wage, and that's all the way they were getting along. Bill was working with alcoholics, trying to get some people sober, and wasn't having much luck with that either. But anyway, he got this lead on the proxy fight to take over this little National Rubber Machinery Company, which made curing presses. Apparently, when you make a tire, you mold the tire, and then you have to use steam to cure it. And the tire curing press, it looks just like one of the vulcanizing machines you'd have in a tire shop. And he went out to Akron, and he solicited proxies, and he thought he had the answer. But when they had the shareholders meeting, why, he didn't have enough, and he lost out. And he tells that in his story. It's in the big book that he wound up out there. He had facing a weekend without anything to do, and maybe he still had some work to do to try to revive his proxy fight the next day. He only had about $10. They had financed him a little bit to go out there, and he hadn't paid his hotel bill or anything. So he was right there in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, and even thought about going in the bar and just having a soda just to strike up an acquaintance. Well, right away that scared him, because for 6 months he had been able to stay sober just by going down to his old hospital and talking to drunks there. And he Nobody, it hadn't gotten anybody sober, but every time he did that, it helped him. It just set him back on his feet to go down to the hospital and talk to a drunk on the bed. So he made a call to a minister in Akron who had some connection with the Oxford group. And he had found his sobriety in the Oxford group. This was a spiritual fellowship that didn't work just with alcoholics, but it had been found to be successful with some drunks. And so he reached a woman named Henrietta Seiberlin, or at least he got some names, and her name was on the list. And at first, he was hesitant to call her. The Seiberlins were a prominent family in Akron. Frank Seiberlin, who founded the Seiberlin Tire Company, had previously founded the Goodyear Tire Company. And at one time on Wall Street, Bill had even met Frank Seiberlin. And he thought that Henrietta Seiberlin was probably Frank's wife. And he was reluctant to call up and announce that he was a rumhead from New York or anything like that. But something told him he should. And he made the call, and it turned out that Henrietta was Frank's daughter-in-law. And she was living in the gatehouse of the Seiberlin Mansion. Now, that's a 40 or 50-room mansion there in Akron, which Frank Seiberlin had built for the family when he had controlled Goodyear. And it's called Stan Hewitt. And Stan Hewitt means stone is found here. Well, Bill was to meet Dr. Bob there, and he called Dr. Bob the Rock of AA. So, hey, that was an appropriate name. But he called up Henrietta and told her that he was a rum hound from New York, and he wanted to talk to another drunk. And it so happened, Henrietta had been in the Oxford group, and they had been trying to help Dr. Bob with his drinking. They hadn't had much luck. But nevertheless, the thing that they'd at least had gotten Dr. Bob to admit that he had a drinking problem. She had one meeting, she said. Now, I used to call her. I talked to her on the phone, but I never met her in person. But this meeting, she wanted everybody to admit something that was very special or dear to them that they were afraid to admit to somebody. And when they got to Dr. Bob, he said, though this may cost me my profession, but I'm a secret drinker. Well, they all knew that he was a drinker. He wasn't a secret at all, but he was just scared to death that he would lose his medical license. Dr. Bob had worked hard to become a doctor. He had had to go back to college a couple of times simply because of his drinking. And he probably had to work harder than the average person just to get there. And so he was just in fear of losing his profession. But anyway, he made this admission. And this was important, see, because one of the first things that you have to do if you're going to help an alcoholic, he has to admit it. If the person doesn't admit he has a drinking problem, you might as well quit right there, because you can't make any progress. But he did make this admission. And that was important, because here Bill calls a couple of weeks later and wants to talk to a drunk. And Henry, this is one of those amazing coincidences, you see, that here Dr. Bob makes this admission, and a week or two later, Bill Wilson makes this call. Henrietta called it manna from heaven. And anyway, she introduced Bill and Dr. Bob in her home, which is the gatehouse to this big Seiberlin mansion. Now, Henrietta had three children, and she was married to the son of Frank Seiberlin, but he was a kind of a playboy, and he was living up in the big house with his parents, and she was living in the gatehouse with her three children. So she invited Bill over. And Dr. Bob came over with his wife Ann, and their son Bob who was only 17 at the time, drove them over because Dr. Bob was too shaky to drive. And anyway, he was only going to talk to Bill for 15 minutes. He said, I'll give this mug 15 minutes. But when Henrietta at first served dinner, and Dr. Bob couldn't eat any dinner, and then afterwards, she shooed them into an adjoining room, and Bill talked to Dr. Bob. And right, they talked for 5 hours, because Bob said that this guy knew what he was talking about from actual experience. Well, Henrietta wanted to keep Bill in Akron to help Dr. Bob, so she got a friend to put Bill up at the Portage Country Club. He had lost the proxy fight for control of this little company, but there was still the possibility that he could maybe revive it to his advantage. So she got him a place to stay at the Portage Country Club, and then a short time later, Ann invited Bill to come over and live in their home. Dr. Bob's son, Smitty, I got to know him quite well, and he said when he and his sister, Susan, had to go sleep up in the attic when they had guests there, because the guest room were their bedrooms. So Bill moved in with them, and Dr. Bob then had to go to a medical convention in New York, and they decided that, well, if he was on good spiritual grounds, he could go there safely and come back sober and so on. But, of course, that wasn't the way it worked out. He started drinking the moment he left, and he came back pretty drunk. And Smitty told me that Bill, when Dr. Bob came back drunk, why, Bill packed his bags. He was going to go back to New York. But Ann, Dr. Bob's wife, talked him into staying and giving it one more try. So they took several days, but they got Bob sober enough. He had to perform an operation on the Wednesday, I guess. And now Dr. Bob was a proctologist. That's a guy who works on a body that gets very little, a part of the body that gets very little sunlight. And I think he depended on referrals from other surgeons for most of his business. And so it was very important that he kept his appointments, that he didn't have to cancel out surgery on another doctor. I'm sure that they were pretty unhappy with him when that happened. But anyway, Bill took him to the hospital and gave him one bottle of beer, and he went in and performed the surgery, and that was the last drink he ever had. Bill dramatized things, you know. Bill said, the patient lived. Well, heck, how many people ever died from a hemorrhoid operation? But anyway, after Bob performed this surgery, he then went around Akron starting to talk to people about what his problem had been, and making amends to anybody he was on the outs with. And he never had another drink. He lived another 15 years. He was older than Bill. Bill was 38 at the time, and Dr. Bob was 56 when they met. But he lived until 1950, and he really became quite an outstanding guy in AA. I think that his stature there in AA was just so great and the fact that he was a doctor, too. Because you read those early stories, they talk about this doctor who had an answer, and that apparently helped draw a lot of people in. And Dr. Bob stayed there in Akron and did his work, and then Bill continued to try to work in New York. But Bill always said that Dr. Bob's work out in Akron was far more successful than what he got. He said that Akron had 80 members when he had 20 in New York. But anyway, it's true in both places. And then, of course, AA started to get favorable publicity. The big thing was the article in the Saturday Evening Post. I think it was in 1941. The Saturday Evening Post was then the leading family magazine in the country. And it sold for a nickel. And when that article by Jack Alexander came out, why, it just brought people in by the thousands. In 1 year, AA grew from 2,000 members to 8,000 in just one week. And so then a lot of other things happened that spurred AA's growth. You know, publicity in different places. AA was very fortunate that there were these gee whiz articles started coming out in newspapers and magazines around the country. I live in Toledo, and I was looking in the old archives of the Toledo Blade, and I saw that a reporter named Seymour Rothman, when he was just a young reporter, had written a whole series of articles for the Toledo Blade. And this had had a tremendous effect on the growth of AA in Toledo. In 1 year, it had grown to maybe 1,000 or 2,000. And I knew Rothman. He lived well into his 90s. And I sometimes would talk to him and tell him that he had helped save a lot of people's lives just with those articles. And I think he deserved to be told that. For the most part, people have been favorable of what they've said about AA, but there have been articles critical of AA. And just by following what Bill told us, the principles, the traditions, and so on, we've been able to survive that. And it's amazing how AA has survived different problems over the years when they've come up, why somehow it's been handled in the right way. Well, I was just told that I only have 10 minutes, and by gosh, I don't think I'll even take that. I think I've said enough here now. This morning, somebody asked me to sing my song about the founders. Is there anybody here who didn't hear the song? Oh, great. Well, I'll sing it again. And I'll close with that. Well, I also want to tell you, I do write limericks once in a while, and I wrote one about myself. A fearful young man from Nebraska drank amounts that would surely aggast you. He'd take any old slop and drink till he'd drop, and finally fell on his Aska. But this one is a tribute to Bill and Bob. Once there were founders, two men we esteem. They had a vision, a sort of a dream. And though they had struggles, they'd never complain. I wish they were with us again. Once there was darkness, no answer was known. Each of us faced a grim future alone. Then came their vision, and new life appeared. Our founders were with us back then. Who can it? Well, I lost that paragraph. Well, you know, something has happened to me here. I must have advanced Alzheimer's. But anyway, I'll have to give up. I'll just have to give up. I'll sing Sioux City Sioux. I drove a herd of cattle down from old Nebraska way. That's how I come to be in the state of Iowa. I met a girl in Iowa. Her eyes were big and blue. I asked her what her name was, and she said, Sioux City Sioux. Sioux City Sioux. Sioux City Sioux. Your hair is red, your eyes are blue. I'd swap my horse and dog for you. Sioux City, Sioux, Sioux City, Sioux, there ain't no gal as true as my sweet Sioux City, Sioux. Thank you very much.